Hi, I'm Jim Stroud.
And this is Karen Matinen, and welcome to the Recruiter's Lounge.
The Recruiter's Lounge is a podcast of news, interviews, and commentary on the recruiting industry. And it was designed with you in mind. So sit back, relax, and enjoy your time in the Recruiter's Lounge.
Okay, you want to start the show or I'll start the show?
No, I don't.
Okay, I'll start. Today's episode of the Recruiter's Lounge is brought to you by HireVue. HireVue is the premier provider of recorded video interview services and every day conducts video interviews around the world. Find them online at www.HireVue, that's HireVue.com, HireVue.com. And they sound so familiar to me. Why are they familiar to me?
Well, we did an interview with them back October 2007.
Oh, yeah. Can we talk to Mark Newman?
Mark Newman, yes. And you really liked them a lot, too, back then. You couldn't stop talking about them.
I do remember that. I thought it was pretty cool. I think you liked them as well because they were doing something different with video resumes or video interviews that
video
no one else was
interview.
Doing.
It's yeah. not the video resume, and which is one of the reasons I like them, because it's specifically what they – this is after the candidate has been chosen.
Right. Well, you know what? Let me get the URL out to people to listen to the podcast as well. That's budurl.com/UUK2, and that will redirect you to the podcast we're talking about, because giving you the exact address of the podcast is very long. So try it again.
You know, or you could just go to hireview.com.
Yeah, you can do that too. Gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome to another exciting, action-packed episode of Recruiter's Lounge. I'm your host with the most, Jim Stroud. And with me in the lounge chair, looking as lovely as she'll ever get, Karen Matinen.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm glad that you're here. Well, you're always here because you're my faithful Indian companion. But I'm glad you're here because we have a special guest who's going to hang out with us at the lounge.
Yes, actually, this one is one of our going to be a little bit more serious than usual, but I think very entertaining and knowledgeable. I asked a friend of mine, her name is Carol Miaskoff. Carol, did I butcher your name or is that said right?
That said almost right, which is as good as it ever gets.
Can you please tell me how to say it better?
Miaskoff.
Okay. Carol, she works at the EEOC. Now, we've had some debates online recently, and I thought, you know, we've got a lot of people out there proclaiming to be experts. I thought the best way to get some of these answers is just to go straight to the EEOC and ask them how, you know, some questions that we in the recruiting world would love to have answered finally. Jim, why don't you ask? Don't you have some questions? Why don't you ask them?
Yes, I'll ask the first question. I shall ask two questions. The first question that I'll ask is, Carol, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much.
I missed that.
I want to start off with a hard question like that first. Just get it started. The second question I wanted to ask is that regarding the EEOC, what does the EEOC mean for a recruiter? I guess that's the first question.
An external recruiter, too. I mean, like what I do. I work for companies, and a lot of companies think they can hide behind me. I mean, they can discriminate by using me. Is that true?
No, it's not true. Well, you've asked me several questions here, and being a systematic lawyer, I'll try to parse my way through them. First of all, the EEOC enforces the federal non-discrimination laws that and started with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. They prohibit employment discrimination on the basis of race, color, national origin, religion, gender, and in other laws, disability and age. They cover employers, they cover employment agencies, they cover labor unions, and they apply to employers with 15 or more employees. For employment agencies, they apply to an employment agency that is attempting to get jobs for employees or employees for jobs.
Even if I'm not hiring that person?
Right. You're an employment agency. You're trying to get people for jobs to match them up. Okay? So people can be covered as employment agencies. There's also law out there, case law, that says that if a recruiter or another individual is acting as an agent under the law as to who is an agent, the law of agency, for an employer, they can be jointly and severally liable with the employer for discrimination. So that would cover the situation where an employer would say, you know, let's be quiet, but between the two of us, I'm not going to hire anyone over 35. So that would pull someone in there on potential liability. Or, by the way, we don't want any really dark-skinned people for front office positions, for example. There's certainly many ways ways people can be pulled in here. And it is definitely clearly applicable. I guess another point to make also is that sometimes people think the EEO laws don't apply until you have an existing employment relationship, you know, that after someone's hired and put on the job, and then, you know, you come to work, and that's sort of where it kicks in, you know, if there's harassment or if there's outright discrimination or something like that. Well, that's not the case. The EEO laws say right at their start that they cover the employment relationship from soup to nuts, from start to finish. And what that means is that they do apply to recruiting. They do apply to selection of individuals for employment, and that process needs to be not discriminatory. So that's my standing on 1 foot summary.
I guess I wanted to ask you. I've debated this with Karen ad nauseum, and I'm sure some of our listeners have heard this so many times, but I guess I want to hear it from somebody else.
Especially from the EEOC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How many grievances or cases does the EEOC deal with in regards to recruiters? Is this like a phenomenon where it's happening all the time, where the EEOC has to stand in because a recruiter was a bad recruiter? Or is this like a onesie-twosie type of deal?
Well, I don't have numbers in front of me, and I don't think our system would track it for independent recruiters, per se. I don't want to try to fake out your audience. I think they fully realize that it's harder to prove discrimination in recruiting and hiring than it is, say, you know, during the employment relationship where things are all documented. It is harder. But nonetheless, we do get charges. We do get calls from people. For example, I got a call from an individual who I then told to file a charge, who told me about his experience with an online application system that asked a particular question could be correlated with discrimination. And if you didn't give the answer that was desired there, the whole system was programmed just simply to shut down and say, thank you for your interest in blank company. That is a sort of an inquiry that we got, and I said, gee, that's interesting. Here's the name. Here's the number of your local EEOC office, should you want to file a charge. So we certainly are quite aware of it. We watch it. We're up with the technology, so we sometimes take a gander through some listings on Craigslist, for example. And I know that's not recruiters per se, but you can see some real doozies in there because people think it's not covered. We watch it, and there certainly are charges out there involving the recruiting and selection stage.
Now, during this economic downturn that we're in, do you see the EEOC get more complaints during this time?
We do. I don't think we've seen the uptick. Well, actually, we are seeing an uptick now. I mean, we already, just to get you a feel, we get 80,000 charges a year.
Your office is at the whole EEOC?
through the whole EEOC.
Okay.
Nationally, we get 80,000 charges a year, and that increases when there are a lot of layoffs, obviously, and economic hard times. It increases as people lose their jobs. You know, I think probably a majority, and that means like 50% or above, so it still does leave a lot, but a majority of our charges are brought after people are let go or fired. Because that is the easiest one, though it's not easy, but to document. So when there's more firings than layoffs, you have more charges.
Now, I've got a question about the charges. I mean, you know, how many charges are actually brought to lawsuits and how much are actually settled? I mean, I've heard something like, is it called arbitration that the EEOC does?
We do mediation, actually. We do mediation, and what we do is we offer mediation to both parties, employer and employee, in cases where, you know, it's not, you know, if we have cases, we obviously sort of do some triage when we get these 80,000 charges in, because we have to. And, you know, backtracking, you know, what we do is we sort of put them into three pots. One pot is the one that it's just really obvious that they don't state a cause of action, as us lawyers would say, right at the get-go. For example, someone doesn't allege discrimination on a basis that's protected by the federal civil rights laws, but they say, you know, he was out to get me because he doesn't like the style of my clothes, you know, something that's clearly not covered. So that's one pot, and those are dismissed quickly. The other extreme is the cases where it's really clear that there was discrimination. For example, we once had an employment agency that when people, it was like a walk-in situation, but when African Americans walked in, the receptionists were trained to put a little mark, you know, a little mark on the corner of the application.
Hmm.
And then those applications were not pursued for, you know, they did not get employment. In a case like that where there's just, you know, lockdown evidence of discrimination, we don't offer mediation. We fast track it into our litigation process. And the ones in the middle are the ones where we do typically offer mediation, where we think there's some evidence of discrimination, but it's not, you know, not all that clear, and there will be some real effort involved in sort of bringing it to a point where it can be resolved on the merits. We do offer mediation to both sides, and both sides have to agree to it. But when it does go forward, it's usually very effective in resolving complaints.
But how many would you say go to mediation, and by how many go to lawsuits?
Well, I'll tell you. Ultimately, not that many go to lawsuit. I don't, you know, I guess I should have pulled together numbers for you today, but I didn't in terms of mediation. But, you know, ultimately we file in federal court, we file between 300 and 400 federal lawsuits every year. So that's a very small number, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But the people, you know, the cases that get that far have already, you know, gone through our investigation process, and even, I should say, even for those cases, you know, where we find outright evidence of discrimination at the get-go, so they're not offered mediation, we are still required by federal law to try to conciliate the case, which means to try to resolve it, you know, I don't want to say in a friendly way, you know, but in, you know, resolve it outside of court. So sometimes some of those cases settle then. But the ones who don't conciliate, then we look at those to decide which ones we're going to litigate. And we pick the ones to litigate where there's a potential significant impact. And that could mean either there are a lot of people involved, or there's an opportunity to make new law on, you know, on a point that we think is particularly important, you know, in the economy at this time, or it's on a legal question, a specific, you know, legal question that there may be law on already, but that we want to try to influence. So that's the way we pick what we're going to litigate. But even for the ones there that we don't litigate, people can still bring a private lawsuit, and often they do. Because when we sign off of it, say we decide, okay, we're not going to litigate this case, we issue the charging parties a letter that's called a right to sue letter. And that essentially can be used to show the court that, you know, these individuals have been good citizens, and they've brought their administrative complaints through the EEOC system, but they haven't been able to be resolved through this whole process. And therefore, you know, the person under the law is justified to go to court. And indeed, any charge that we don't take to litigation gets a right to sue letter.
Wow.
So it's both the worthwhile ones, in our opinion, and the ones where we have not found it likely that there's discrimination. Everyone gets a right to sue letter. And, you know, I've seen lots of cases. I've seen cases, by the way, you know, and lots of them, where, you know, a situation where we may not have said it's likely that there is discrimination, but people have nonetheless brought lawsuits. And I think my important point here is, and they're not specious lawsuits, because once you get a private attorney involved and get some heavy-duty discovery going on, you really do find some, you know, real evidence of discrimination. So I have seen cases like that have ended up going to the courts privately, and where the charging party has prevailed in court. So,
and on that one too, if I'm a lawyer and you guys did some discovery, and my client wants to, you know, do their own suing, can we utilize your discovery that you guys may have done in research?
That's always a tricky question. I think the answer is yes on that. I think the charging party themselves can always get their own file. It's tricky, though, because there's, believe it or not, a criminal provision in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act that says that any EEOC employee who breaches confidentiality on any charge, any administrative charge of discrimination, now that has not yet gone to court, who breaches confidentiality can actually be charged criminally for breaching that confidentiality. So we're really careful about that. But I do think despite that, it is possible, someone can get their own file, you know, because that's not breaching their confidentiality.
Now, here's another question. I'm a company, and I have been using recruiters, and I've been trying to utilize them to cover up my discrimination. This is a hypothetical. I don't use third party because I am one. Okay, but I wanted to just use a hypothetical scenario. Now, I think that I'm not going to get busted. I'm not going to get caught. I'm okay. I heard of a situation where the EEOC was able to get permission from the courts to go ahead and open up one particular recruiting's all of their caseload and be able to investigate their clients. I mean, does that happen a lot or no?
I'm not familiar with it. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Okay.
You know, I'm just not familiar.
Because, I mean, it's like, why should I as a company then? Because I have a theory that if for every finger that's pointing at your recruiter, there's three pointing back with you, at you, your Mr. Employer. So I'm wondering, though, should that be one of the reasons I would be scared, or do I really not have to worry about it? Just if my recruiter gets busted, will I get busted? Is that potential for it?
Of course. Of course. If your recruiter gets busted, you know, the first thing we're going to want to know is what companies has this recruiter been working with. Of course. And so, of course, if your recruiter is discriminating and there's a trail back to you, you know, any sort of self-respecting federal law enforcement official would follow it.
Now, one other question.
Let me ask you this, Carol, just to digress just slightly. There are a lot of recruiters, of course, listening, and I'm sure is there at least some of their practice to only post their jobs on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just convenient for them, and they're using Monster, Career Builder, and whatever, and they're
right.
Other jobs.
Right.
They get in trouble for just doing that? I mean, do they have to post in newspapers and magazines and so forth? And if they do, are you guys going to look at them hard, or are you going to just look at the ones like the big fish, say the Microsofts and Googles of the world who are really big?
Mm-hmm.
Look at the small.
And he's saying recruiters. He's talking about the ones that work for companies as well. Like there are some companies that only utilize the Internet for their recruiting habits. They won't.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I'm aware of that. That's a subject of ongoing internal debate here, to be honest. But there have been no instances so far where we've gone after a company simply for just posting on the internet, you know, for only posting on the internet, you know, or, you know, a recruiter for only posting on the internet. It gets very touchy. I mean, it first of all would be a disparate impact theory, which is a complex and challenging area of the law to prove a case in any respect. There may still be a disproportionate number of minorities who are not online, though that in itself is open to dispute, and the sort of divisions in terms of who's online and who's not, I think have maybe more to do with age, perhaps. And there's so many studies out there, like women, I think, believe it or not, are more proficient on some of this stuff than men. A lot of minorities are, of course, are online, and it's a complex area, and so certainly the last thing we want to do is start reinforcing perhaps stereotypes.
So that
in itself is probably not going to be a problem, though. Things could change, but I wouldn't think so. That said, our advice to big companies certainly is to use several outlets, for their employment ads, to not, only use, one or two of the big job boards, and to use some non-internet outlets too. We certainly advise that, and indeed we've always advised that, even, before the internet. We've always said, don't just post it, your job in one place that reaches a limited group of people. Indeed, there's at this point a fairly old court opinion, but that nonetheless I think makes an important point. And it's an opinion. It's out of the Detroit area, and I think it was one of the suburbs of Detroit was recruiting for police officers. And they made a point of only putting their ads in some of the suburban, the suburban local, local rags. You know what I'm talking about, the ones that are, thrown and you don't, on your lawn in the morning and you don't really want them. They only did it in the suburban papers for the white suburbs. They didn't do it for the city of Detroit, for the areas that were predominantly African American at that time. And that was challenged, and they lost. And I think the lesson to that is don't do single sourcing recruiting.
I was going to ask you about that because I'd heard about that story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would like to ask another question, too, that's kind of keep forgetting to ask. I'm under the impression that the EEOC is not only the only place that I could file a discrimination suit. Especially in certain states, I think that confuses people too, because there's an impression that the EEOC is cutting back, and that where therefore you guys are understaffed and don't get to do them. But I'm like, well, even it's like that's not the only the EEOC is not the only government agency that deals with this, anyways. But they're, and that's also a misnomer. Two questions, actually.
Right. First of all, for the people who are saying EEOC is cutting back and, we're overwhelmed and we're dispirited and don't worry about enforcement, I guess I would just say that regardless of the numbers of people here, I've been working now for 30 years or more, which is dating me, obviously, but EEOC, of all my workplaces, EEOC is the place by far with the most committed, enthusiastic workforce I have ever seen. So what you're dealing with is, even if there are fewer numbers, you have people working here who are deeply committed to the mission of the agency and who, if humanly possible, are going to do more with less. annoying saying that management always says in times of downsizing, do more with less. But I think we do have a workforce here that, because of their commitment to the work of the agency, will, in any circumstances where it is remotely possible, will do more with less. That said, I would guess that a lot of your recruiters have heard about outsourcing.
Yeah.
You know, and the whole, you know, the world is flat approach and outsourcing. Well, EEOC outsources, and we have for a long time. And what our outsourcing is, essentially, is literally contracts that we have with many, many, many state and local EEO agencies, fair employment practices agencies, civil rights agencies. Almost all of those state and local ones are under contract with us. And what that means is that they are authorized to accept the charges of discrimination, you know, that would have, that would sound, so to speak, under the federal laws. And they accept them, and they are entered into a shared database. And often they in those situations, the state or local does the triaging I was talking about and probably does some of the investigation. But we are all in it together, and clearly in some instances those complaints, you know, can be referred to us and traded back and forth, et cetera. And they do, as I said, sound under our laws, so people, I think, I'm fairly sure, can get the right to sue letter. So that's one way we do outsourcing, so to speak. The other way, which I do as part of my sort of bread and butter job here that I was hired to do, was we coordinate with sort of a whole network of other federal agencies that have civil rights offices that monitor the private sector. And certainly, you know, I presume your recruiters, many of them work for government contractors. Well, because of the contract, they are subject to OFCCP's requirements under the OFCCP executive order. We coordinate with OFCCP, so when they get individual complaints of discrimination at OFCCP, they actually refer them to EEOC. When OFCCP gets class complaints of discrimination, i.e. those involving, you know, a lot of people complaining together at the same time about the same employer, in some instances OFCCP will investigate it. In some instances, they'll refer it to us. So we work with them. We also work with the civil rights agencies, or civil rights offices, at the agencies that do a huge amount of grant making. For example, Health and Human Services, through the Medicare and Medicaid program, virtually every health care provider, you know, going from a hospital down to the smallest corner pharmacy, receives federal funds. And with that comes certain civil rights obligations. So we coordinate with them. And indeed, if someone files a complaint with HHS's Office of Civil Rights, they may end up sending it to us if it's predominantly an employment complaint. Same thing with Department of Education for all the school systems. So it's a pretty wide net out there.
Wow.
And a very complicated, but very extensive.
That is interesting to hear. I mean, I'm glad you put that one to rest, because what you're saying is that it's like a lot of people feel, oh, no problem, I could do it because it's not easy to get caught. I mean, I don't know. I've heard that recently there were over 450 employment lawsuits, obviously not all EEOC and its grievances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was like,
right.
They said daily, over 450 employment lawsuits. That's
mm-hmm.
a lot of lawsuits.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And
yes,
you consider that, I mean, I once heard statistics, something like 80% of these charges didn't go to lawsuits. That makes
right.
it more scary.
Right. I think that's probably true, that about, you know, clearly, I mean, given the numbers I gave you earlier, clearly most charges don't go to a lawsuit. But that does, nonetheless, I think dealing with an administrative, even an administrative charge of discrimination, is from a company's point of view, a pain in the neck to deal with, and a sort of sink of funds. You know, you're going to have to, have lawyers involved to deal with it, and it's going to take time and it's going to take money.
Carol, what is what is co-employment or joint employment? I've heard a term before, but I'm not really sure how it's technically defined.
Yeah, right. It's called joint employment.
Okay.
And that's something that often sort of relates to the outsourcing phenomenon, basically, although it's an established legal principle that's been around for quite a while. Legally, that goes back to how do you decide when someone's an employee versus when someone's an independent contractor? And there is a Supreme Court case from many years ago, maybe 10 to 15 to 20 years ago at this point. It's the short form. It's called the Darden case, D-A-R-D-E-N. And in that, the Supreme Court talked about all of the many really fact-intensive factors that you look at to decide if someone's an employee or an independent contractor. And those are things, obviously, like who pays the salary, who withholds taxes, who provides the benefits. But it's also things like who provides the equipment needed to do the job, who gives someone their work assignments, who receives their work assignments, who has power to terminate the relationship, and why. So there are many factors. I think the list actually, it's a very long list if you list out all the factors listed in that Supreme Court case. And those factors are used widely now in any employment context, including, in a tax context, to decide if people are properly categorized as employees or independent contractors. And those same factors are used, in the context of the EO laws. In our laws, obviously we only cover employees, so you have to get through that first step, that someone's an employee, not a contractor. But we also look at those factors when deciding, and sometimes in outsourcing situations, you will essentially have one employee with two employers. And that's in situations where you essentially have one entity that's doing the salary, doing the taxes, doing, figuring out the 401k contributions, et cetera. That's doing all that. So the person is paid by that entity, so, you kind of think, gee, that's an employer. Nonetheless, the person is stationed at a client company. And when you have situations where the person is at the client company and they're sitting in an office with maybe other contractors from their company, with contractors from other companies, with permanent employees, and they're working on projects and they have interactions with other employees and supervisors from the client company, and say the client company has input, if not sometimes in reality, basically decision-making power about whether or not the person continues to work there, then the client company will also be considered an employer. So you essentially have a case where both the client company and the paying company, so to speak, the company that does the paycheck, where they're both employers of one employee. And that's important because if that individual at the client site, say, is subject to sexual harassment, those two employers are going to be jointly and severally liable for the sexual harassment. So that means if the person goes to the client company and says, Joe over here, who's an employee of another contractor, or Jeff over there, who's your employee, are sexually harassing me, the client needs to deal with it and needs to correct the situation, and is not, is sort of ill-advised to say, well, tough luck, you're a contractor. It doesn't, no skin off my back. So that's the idea.
Carol, that brings me to a question that was really interesting in regards to how a recruiter once got held responsible for the hiring decisions of a hiring manager. The story I heard about, when this also was written up on the EEOC's webpage, was a recruiter was asked to replace a candidate that she had placed. Mm-hmm. And the candidate was, because the candidate told the employer she was pregnant. And this was all within the replacement guarantee for the recruiter's time frame. It was within 90 days.
Right.
So the recruiter went ahead and replaced the pregnant candidate.
Right.
And the company, so then not only did the company get held liable for discrimination, mm-hmm. but also the recruiter got held liable.
Right. I don't think that was a joint. Well, I don't know if it was a joint employment situation per se, so let's leave that aside.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I mean, as I said, these laws, Title VII covers employment agencies, which is defined as finding people for a vacancy or vacancy for people who are looking to work. So she might have been covered in that respect, as a recruiter herself. Apart from coverage, because she was covered, the recruiter is not allowed to discriminate on the basis of sex. And Title VII defines pregnancy as discriminating on the basis of pregnancy to be the same as discriminating on the basis of sex.
I remember.
So she's on the hook for it. And, I know you guys are all, all the recruiters are just going to totally snicker at this. But EEOC's position is if someone tells them, if a client says discriminate on this prohibited basis, like pregnancy, the recruiter is supposed to tell them, that's illegal. I'm not doing it. I can't do that. That's
and
illegal.
That can
get us both in troubles.
And if it does not do that, then what happens?
Then what happens? Well, ideally what I'm saying ideally here, and I hear the snickers in the background, but, the employer says, I'm not going to get rid of her just because she's pregnant.
In this situation, too, I know one of the arguments utilized was that the recruiter said, but I was honoring my agreement.
Right.
The judge said, but you can't honor an illegal request.
That's right. It's an illegal request, and under contract law, there's a principle that contracts are void if they violate public policy, and violating a federal law is clearly violating public policy. So the contract, would not be held valid if the contract, if indeed, it was found that the contract required her to do that.
So. Well, Kara, I'll tell you, this has been so informative. I know a lot of recruiters will be playing this over and over again. Just to make sure that they are covered. I just want to thank you for your time here in the Recruiter's Lounge.
Sure enough.
It was awesome. Thank you. I really do appreciate it, and I hope that we can invite you again.
I'd be happy to join you again.
Thank you.
Okay, it was a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Well, that's the end of our show, and as always, you've been a very great audience. If you like what you heard, love what you heard, or simply hate what you just heard, please let us know. You can reach me, Jim Stroud, at jim@therecruiterslounge.com or karen@therecruiterslounge.com. Also, if you would, please subscribe to us by iTunes or just subscribe to the site, of course, therecruiterslounge.com. The theme song of The Recruiter's Lounge is courtesy of Brain Bucket and the PodSafe Music Network. Find them online at music.podshow.com.